It's the Marketplace Tech Podcast for Monday the 18th. I'm Ben Johnson in New York. As we've been reporting, it's a matter of days until bulk data collection built into the Patriot Act expires. Meanwhile, legislative restrictions on data and surveillance are afoot, so maybe a good time to check in about data privacy and how it might manifest in the physical world. Harvard's Jonathan Zittrain has been thinking big thoughts about this because, as you know, the dude is good at thinking big thoughts. Professor Zittrain, nice to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Is there such a thing as an individual really being able to leverage power with their individual sets of data?
Well, most people think of us as playing defense rather than offense, but I think it's a neat idea to be thinking of both sides of the equation. There's both kind of informational privacy, the data that you generate as you surf around the internet, and there's kind of a little bit more visceral privacy that has to do with the fact that we're all proliferating cameras and microphones and possibly meerkatting or periscoping our way into transmitting that live. And the prospect that you might just be walking down the street and under live surveillance by a fellow human is a relatively new phenomenon.
Is it possible that collective bargaining is a more effective route for people when it comes to using their data or taking a stand?
In the more visceral space, again, I could see, and I think we ought to have, a way of, for example, being able to set a physical room to on the record or off the record. So maybe a classroom is on the record for a talk, and then later for a seminar it goes off the record. And if somebody tries to start recording and broadcasting out, that person will be alerted, hey, the room is set to off the record. Are you sure you want to do this?
That's a really interesting idea, that the physical spaces that we would inhabit might have an on-off switch when it comes to recording data that's being generated in that physical space.
Exactly. And I should emphasize, this isn't about somehow trying to control what people can do. It's a way of sending signals, though, and being able to very clearly set expectations so that if people want to violate them, they know that that's what they're doing and they end up taking responsibility for that.
Jonathan Zittrain is co-founder of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
All right, you knew them when they were merely modded Toyota Priuses. You saw them when they evolved into cartoonish rounded cabs with a tiny data brain mounted on top. And the other day, Google's self-driving cars were given the go-ahead to hit public roads in Mountain View, California. Part of the plan is to troubleshoot. What kind of trouble? Here's Ryan Kahlo at the University of Washington's School of Law.
What they're going to be troubleshooting is all the little things that come up in your daily drive, like an intersection that's broken or someone on a bicycle. I think they're going to be troubleshooting the kinds of things that humans encounter and have to adapt to rather than being terribly concerned about the safety and ordinary driving conditions.
Don't freak out about killer robot cars just yet. Google's vehicles probably won't get pulled over for speeding either. They have a speed cap of 25 miles an hour, and they also have a safety driver on board. Kahlo says these tests might inform regulations in the future about how humans need to be trained to be passengers.
We need to understand exactly what kinds of testing or licensing a person who is a passenger or a potential driver undergoes, because presumably it will be different than the kind of driving test that you and I have taken.
Ryan Kahlo there. Google's cars are scheduled to get on public roads in Mountain View this summer. Today, the latest season of The Bachelorette begins on ABC. I won't be blowing your mind when I tell you I'm not a religious viewer of this show, but the website Bustle has tried to know its logical conclusion. I talked to Bustle editor Martha Soren. She has mined the social media posts of contestants to get hints about which eligible gentleman came out on top.
While the contestants are filming the show, they're not allowed to use the internet, their phones, they have no outside contact. But then they'll show back up after they get eliminated and they'll post again. So that's kind of how you can see how long they've been on the show recording.
There's also, I guess, a production value in waging a form of psychological warfare on the contestants by not allowing them to use the internet.
Definitely. They have nothing else to talk about but the person that they're there to start seeing. So it causes more fights and it causes more drama because they're so isolated.
Let's get to the brass tacks. Who won?
I couldn't pick an exact winner, but I picked about 10 that you should keep an eye on, and then I ruled about 10 out.
What else do you think is interesting about the way that social media informs the business model of reality television and vice versa?
You know, it's definitely something they have to consider that they didn't have to consider when the show first started. Because now, you know, you have to make sure there's no spoilers. And you also want to keep them talking to the fans, though, to keep the show interesting.
Have you seen the show itself change in certain ways because of social media and the internet?
I have, actually.
Like, are people walking around, like, hashtagging?
They are. Oh, my gosh. There was a guy a couple seasons ago who would say hashtag before everything he said. It was so annoying. But, you know, the producers pay attention to what people are saying on Twitter. And so, you know, this past season of The Bachelor, they actually had a whole segment where they made fun of how often the contestants say amazing. And I feel like that's the kind of thing that, you know, they might not have picked up on if it wasn't the fans saying all the time on Twitter, like, oh my God, these girls think everything is amazing. So I think that they're listening a little bit.
Martha Soren is a TV editor at Bustle. Martha, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I'm Ben Johnson, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.